not, she asked herself as she answered her own question. Because each of the couples were busy and not listening to any sounds around them. Again, good night, Chaika. They felt certain there was no way he would get any sleep that night. He was in a cabin, less than 2 meters away from a woman in a bed. Perkins was a lieutenant colonel and his commanding officer, and like him, she was wearing long pants and a t-shirt. But he could not stop himself from imagining what she was like under those unflattering army-issue clothes. Blood was pounding in his ears from the excitement of having heard one and possibly two couples in amorous celebrations. He tried to think of anything else to keep his mind and other body parts from focusing on the woman sleeping or not sleeping, almost close enough to touch, and found his thoughts wandering back to Earth, to his grandparents' summer cottage on a lake in the countryside west of Milwaukee. He found his mind drifting back to lazy summer days at the lake, swimming and canoeing and fishing and cookouts and riding his bicycle over to visit friends. Blessedly, he began to lose focus, and as the exhausting day caught up with him, he soon fell asleep. Perkins had set an alarm on her Z-phone so she could get up earlier than Chaika and minimize the awkwardness of waking up close to each other. Chaika must have set an alarm even earlier than hers because she was awakened by the sound of the cabin door sliding open. You're up?
Yes, ma'am.
He put a hand over his mouth to stifle a shuddering yawn.
Ma'am, hitting the shower. I'll be back soon.
She could barely see him in the light of the status panel. For a reason she could not explain, and couldn't attribute only to the fog of her just-awakened brain, she asked,
"How did you sleep?"
Immediately she cringed at the question that seemed much too intimate.
Good. I think my mattress is set too soft. I'll change it tonight.
Dave did not know why he was dragging out the conversation when all he wanted was to get out of the cramped cabin as fast as he could.
Be back soon.
His words made him cringe, so he sped across the common area to the washroom and shut the door behind him, then slapped his forehead in dismay. He had not brought any clean clothes with him, so after a quick shower, he would be putting yesterday's clothes back on. Fortunately, uniform pants and shirts all looked the same, so he could change in the cabin later while Perkins took her turn in the washroom.
"Did I wake you last night?"
Perkins asked Irene and Shauna quietly.
"No, ma'am. Why?"
Irene asked innocently while lacing her boots in the common area.
"I got up in the middle of the night, tripped on my boots, and fell against the wall. These walls," she rapped her knuckles on a partition, "are thin, and they transmit sound."
No.
Irene stared intently at her boots, unable to look Perkins in the eye, and with the corner of one eye, she saw Shauna was also suddenly focused on her own footwear.
"I didn't hear anything."
"No harm done, then."
Perkins tried to inject levity into her tone.
"I'll tuck my boots under the bunk tonight," she announced, satisfied the two women had gotten her message.
Breakfast for the humans had been a quick meal of granola bars made in Lemuria and a sort of herbal tea, with the herbs also grown in Lemuria.
"Better than most MREs I've choked down over the years," Dave mumbled quietly over a mouthful of granola that was so tough to chew that he had to wash it down with the tea.
The human diet on Paradise was still limited and too often bland, as UNEF had not brought plants to grow many commonly used spices. One thing they did have was peppers, and Jesse enjoyed a fiery chili sauce, but he got tired of it after a while. The Ruhar had been experimenting to see whether some of their spices could safely be ingested by humans. Even though Ruhar food did not provide any nutrition, their spices might serve to make the bland human diet more palatable.
"I hope you still feel that way when we've been eating this every freaking morning," Jesse whispered.
Chapter 9
"Pone. Corn pone. Hey, Jesse!" Dave called out louder and louder to catch his comrade's attention. "Kind of busy here." Jesse snapped back, concentrating on the view in his visor.
He was running back images and data of the last zero-G combat assault exercise, in which a pair of Ruhar cadets soundly spanked Jesse, Dave, Shauna, and Perkins. Worse than the shame of losing badly was the taunting from the hamster cadets, and Jesse was determined to figure out where the humans had gone wrong so the next exercise wasn't so one-sided. He had already watched the actual exercise, with the ship's training AI pointing out all the mistakes made by the four humans. Now he was intently watching a rerun of the exercise as the AI suggested it should have been conducted.
Talk to you.
Now, Pone, Dave declared as he tore the visor upward, cutting off the exercise.
Game time is over. The battle group got a call for real action.
No shit, Jesse asked excitedly, any annoyance he felt forgotten.
We're gonna see action?
When Jesse got back to the Mavericks' shared quarters, he was disappointed to see Dave and Shauna sitting in front of the bulkhead display.
We're gonna watch from here? I wanna see for real, not on some display.
Jesse tapped the display with disgust.
Ski, you with me?
Before Dave could answer, Shauna put hands on her hips. Is this like on Paradise when the two of you froze your asses off on the ice to watch that maser cannon test fire?
She might be right, Pone, Dave said with an uncertain look on his face.
Come on. Jesse was not going to be dissuaded. You telling me you both don't want to see a whole group of starships maneuvering away and jumping into action? There must be some place on this tub we can watch through a viewport. What about that porthole dome thing where the flight control crew monitors dropship retrievals? There won't be any flight operations now, right?
We shouldn't go anywhere without clearing it with Colonel Perkins first, Shauna objected.
Jesse noted she had said we rather than you to the idea of watching the fleet jumping away.
Okay, I'll contact her.
He pulled his Z-phone off his belt.
We've seen ships come onto and off Star Carrier docking platforms plenty of times before, Dave noted.
They had observed that activity while outside their ship in zero-G combat training during the 5 weeks they had been aboard the ship.
And jumps, too, he remembered, recalling when their training had been halted temporarily so they could turn away from a starship jumping away behind them.
Ordinarily, ships would not jump anywhere near a person free-floating outside a ship, but as combat ops might include that happening. Their training had to include what spaceborne troops should do if they were outside in a spacesuit and a nearby ship needed to jump. Nearby was a relative term, because the gamma radiation from a jump could kill anyone in a spacesuit within 3,000 kilometers, even with the suit's radiation shielding fully engaged. Dave remembered being frightened when he felt a tingling sensation after his suit's sensors picked up the gamma ray burst of an outbound jump. And he had almost panicked in fear the Ruhar-made suit had failed to account for the differences of human physiology. Within seconds, he realized the tingling was only the suit's anti-radiation shield powering down after the gamma rays passed by. But he did have a moment of gut-wrenching fear. He didn't want to feel that fear again.
Oh, hey, Jesse.
Dave held up a finger before Jesse could press the send button on his Z-phone.
Maybe those viewports aren't protected against gamma rays, you know?
I'll ask about it, Jesse assured his friend as he sent the message, then checked the reply.
Huh. Damn it. Colonel said no. She doesn't want us wandering around the ship.
That's fair. Shauna patted Jesse's shoulder.
Dave's right. We don't know if it's safe to watch a jump through those viewports.
We could have asked. Jesse stuck out his lip in an exaggerated pout.
Oh. My poor man,
Shauna played along.
Damn, are you trying for sympathy sex, Jesse? Dave asked with disgust.
That depends. Jesse flashed a grin at Shauna.
Would that work? We'll see.
She bit his earlobe, then pushed him away as he tried to grab her ass.
You want to see this action, remember?
Oh, yeah. All Jesse could think of right then was Shauna. Whatever he was going to say next was drowned out by the blaring of an alarm, and an automated announcement familiar enough that none of the three humans needed their Z-phone translators. Prepare for maneuvering, the announcement stated.
Hot damn! Jesse punched a fist above his head. Are we going into action?
The answer to Jesse's great disappointment was a resounding no. While they waited, the team's two pilots came into the shared quarters, having been chased away from flight training while the ship prepared to maneuver for real. The Rue Tostella did power up and detach from the Star Carrier's docking platform,
and did fire its normal space engines to get clear of the Star Carrier before that vessel jumped away to drop off the second part of the Ruhar task force. But the toaster simply hung dead in space, while the giant Jirapta ship created a powerful jump field and disappeared in a flash of gamma rays, taking the other Ruhar warships with it.
"That's it, then?" Jesse clenched his fists. "We're just going to wait here while the rest of the task force goes into action?"
"Coulter," Irene admonished the soldier gently. "This is a training ship, mostly run by cadets. You didn't think they'd take this bucket into a real engagement, did you?"
"We're carrying real weapons," Jesse retorted, before adding a, "Ma'am."
While it was true that most of the ordnance carried in the ship's magazines were training equipment that was oddly painted almost the same shade of blue the U.S. military used to designate inert practice weapons, Jesse had seen genuine war shots on a tour of the ship's portside aft missile magazine. He also knew the ship's maser cannons and railgun batteries were capable of inflicting real punishment to an enemy. If needed, the Rue Testella could be transformed from training ship to light cruiser in a couple days of hard work.
"Do you know what's going on?"
Irene blew hair out of her eyes, then retied her flyaway ponytail.
"Two hamster ships practicing a stealth recon mission found something odd. Debris from a Ruhar civilian ship at a remote rendezvous site. If the Commodore or the Beatles thought it was really serious, they would have reported it in before sending ships to investigate. My guess is the civilian ship suffered an engineering failure, and the Commodore thinks this is a perfect opportunity for realistic training. The toaster isn't going with the task force in case there is any real danger."
"Out here?" Shauna fiddled with the controls, expanding the view on the display.
"This area was chosen for training because it is quiet."
"It's quiet now." Irene stood and traced a fingernail along a line on the display. "Until recently, this line was the border of Theranan-controlled space. If those little green MFers have second thoughts about ceding this territory to the Jirapta, this sector could get hot real quick." She bit her fingernail in a girlish gesture that got Derek's full attention.
"But I doubt it. If the task force thought the toaster could be in a hazardous situation, we would be at action stations, and we're not."
Shauna automatically looked up at the threat condition indicator above the door. It showed yellow because the ship was maneuvering, but no external threat was anticipated.
"How long until we know?"
Irene looked to Derek, who answered.
"The ships on recon duty took 3 jumps to get back here, so they'll take that many to return to the site they want to investigate. Then the Commodore might want to use the opportunity for fleet maneuvers. A couple days at least. Our training will be restricted in case the toaster needs to move in a hurry, so no space combat exercises outside the ship." He looked at Jesse. "And no flying around in dropships for us pilots. I'm sure the crew will think of something to keep the cadets busy and morale up."
Irene was unfortunately correct. All the fun training was on hold while the Rue Testella waited for the task force to return. For the two pilots, there was no zooming around in dropships, so they used their time in a simulator, training to fly starships. Perkins mostly used the time in the ship's central control center, a combination bridge and CIC, learning as much as she could about space warfare tactics, command and control, and anything else she could absorb. Shauna, Dave, and Jesse were bitterly disappointed because they had been scheduled to perform a live space dive from orbit to the surface of a planet. And now that phase of the training might be canceled because the task force had a tight schedule and the cadets needed to return to school. They had been intensively training for 3 weeks to qualify for a real space dive, and now they might never get the opportunity. All 3 of them had been looking forward to the space dive because several of the hamster cadets had already done it, and the 3 humans were eager to show they could do anything a hamster brat could do. And because no one could be considered to be spaceborne army without having made a real dive from orbit to the surface of a planet. And because they all wanted something to brag about when they returned to paradise. And because, damn it, a space dive from orbit just sounded like a whole lot of fun. Nert was also glum about having the fun parts of training put on hold, but he was excited to finally have the humans join him for lunch in the galley closest to their assigned quarters. The Ruhar cadet had been inviting them to lunch since their first day aboard the ship, but their different training schedules had never allowed them the time. Dave and Jesse slapped together sandwiches and walked forward, warily looking through the door.
Nert had suggested they arrive late, when lunch was winding down and fewer Ruhar would be jamming the tables there. He knew the humans felt awkward about being aboard an alien ship, and his fellow cadets would openly gawk at the humans as curious objects. Nert wanted the two Mavericks to wear their medals, reminding the cadets of how this group of primitive aliens had saved thousands of lives on Paradise, twice. But Dave explained the cadets might resent the humans for showing off, so the medals stayed tucked away in their cabins.
"Hello, Misters Cornpone and Ski," Nert beamed with delight as he saw his two friends standing in the doorway.
He was thrilled to use nicknames for the team, although Jesse had cautioned him that while it was acceptable to call the three sergeants by the first names or nicknames, the three commissioned officers should be referred to by their ranks or last names. That had confused Nert, as the Ruhar military did not have a distinction between types of officers. There were no sergeants, warrant officers, or petty officers in the Ruhar military. When David tried to explain why sergeants were non-commissioned officers, Nert had asked why an experienced staff sergeant should have to take orders from a second lieutenant who had zero experience. Dave had ruefully replied that he had the same question, but that's the way it was.
"Hey, Nerdy,"
Dave used the nickname they used for their liaison officer.
"Looks like the place is still plenty busy."
He looked around to see most tables were lined with cadets sitting elbow to elbow.
"Should we come back later?"
"No, please, come in,"
Nert gestured eagerly, his expression anxious and eager.
"I have a table for us?"
He pointed to a corner where one lunch tray sat by itself.
"Okay."
Jesse shrugged and walked in, nodding to acknowledge the staring hamster cadets. The three sat down, and the humans took out their peanut butter sandwiches, chosen because they didn't want to eat anything that might smell offensive to the Ruhar.
"I am sorry,"
Nert shook his head and looked down at his food.
"The slusho machine is broken."
He pointed to another corner of the galley where a stainless steel machine had a piece of yellow tape across it.
"Oh, okay."
Dave was confused.
"What is that?"
"Slusho is a drink you humans may consume without harm. I checked."
His chin bobbed up and down with frantic seriousness.
"It would not provide any nutrition to you, but,"
he grinned,
"my mother tells me slusho has no nutritional value to anyone."
"I like it already," Jesse grinned back. "What's that you're drinking?"
"Oh, no."
Nert paused from gulping down a greenish-yellow fluid that fizzed like soda.
"This is Slurm, my favorite. My mother says I am addicted to it, but it is just delicious. I..."
He covered his mouth with embarrassment as he shook with a loud burp that drew attention from Ruhar at nearby tables.
"I'm sorry?"
The cadet looked stricken.
"Hey, Nerdy, don't worry about it. I get the same reaction from a Coke, and man, I wish I could have a Coke right now."
Jesse closed his eyes, imagining an ice-cold soft drink rather than the ship's recycled water they were stuck with.
"That's, we call it a soda. It's fizzy like that Slurm stuff you're drinking."
"I think you humans can drink Slurm also. Here, try it."
He held the cup out toward Jesse.
"Thanks, Nerdy, but we should wait for an okay from the colonel."
Nert sipped his drink more slowly and asked about their orientation tour that morning while they ate. The galley was clearing out as cadets had to report to their next training session. Another shift of cadets came into the galley, getting food and staring intently at the three sitting by themselves. Dave noticed none of the incoming cadets joined their table, instead squeezing in where they could at other tables.
"They don't want to sit with us strange aliens, huh?" Dave whispered.
"Oh."
Nert was crestfallen.
"Do not be insulted, Mr. Ski. I am not."
He frowned and looked at the table.
"I usually eat by myself. I am not popular in this crew. I mean, with the cadets in my school."
"They're just jealous that you're famous. You saved two giant transport ships from being blown up by Kristang commandos."
Dave patted the cadet on the back.
"No, I was not popular before that either."
Nert sounded miserable.
"I have never been good at making friends, and it is worse now."
"You're great at making friends with us."
Is that biffed asshole making trouble for you?
Jesse looked around the galley but did not see that particular cadet. Jesse had been around Ruhar long enough that they no longer all looked the same to him.
He is not helping,
Nert admitted.
Biffed is very popular. He has a group of friends who are...
He looked up while trying to think of the correct word in English.
They are much admired at the academy.
Dave and Jesse looked at each other. They knew at Nert's age being popular was the most important thing in the entire universe. They needed to think of a way to make Nert cool to his fellow cadets.
Hey, Nertster.
Dave winked while the young alien unhappily sipped slurm through a straw. Dave held out a fist, and Nert bumped it with a questioning look.
Don't you worry. I got an idea.
The next night, the Mavericks were seated at the back of a large briefing room that was being used for a sort of talent show that evening, as part of the adult crew's effort to keep the cadets busy and entertained while the battle group was away. Perkins had requested for her team to be seated at the back, because that way her people were not on display, unless the Ruhar turned around and stared openly. When a few cadets did that, a reprimanding look from officers straightened them out quickly. The talent was mostly musical, with Perkins finding that she actually enjoyed much of the alien selections. The Ruhar had stringed instruments like guitars and violins, horns sort of like trumpets, and a keyboard. She did not see anything like the clarinet she had once tried to play when she was young, and she was grateful not to be reminded of too many hours sitting inside practicing when she would rather have been outside. A three-person band just finished performing a pop tune that sounded a bit like an old Beatles song, and Perkins was surprised to see Nert stand and walk onto the stage by himself, a goofy grin on his face. The crowd murmured when they saw Nert step up to the microphone, and that instead of having a musical instrument in his hands, he carried a large cup of some fizzy liquid.
What is he doing? Perkins whispered to Irene, who shrugged because she had no idea.
Don't you worry, Colonel, Dave whispered back with a wink as Nert began quickly chugging his drink.
What the hell did you do?
Shauna hissed at Jesse, loud enough that several Ruhar in front of them turned around to see what the commotion was about. Jesse squeezed Shauna's hand.
Watch. It's gonna be epic.
If you embarrass Nerdy...
Shauna squeezed back hard, and she was not being friendly.
This is a human song,
Nert explained to the audience. He tipped back the cup to finish drinking. Then he burped the song loudly into the microphone.
Happy birthday, happy birthday. Happy birthday to you.
He finished with a sheepish grin, unsure of himself. For a split second, there was complete silence in the room. Then, because of Nert's goofy grin, and because the cadets were, after all, teenagers, the hall exploded with uncontrollable laughter. Some cadets laughed so hard they fell out of their chairs, and that prompted another round of laughing. Nert made a short bow, having been coached not to overreach, and stepped down from the stage, making his way back to his chair. He was greeted by back slaps and many raised pinky fingers in a gesture that was the Ruhar equivalent of a thumbs up. Before he sat down triumphantly, he pointed to Jesse and Dave, then mimed a high five. The two men returned the gesture. In a move they had planned, the two humans held their hands out and bowed repeatedly toward the beaming cadet as if worshipping an idol. That gesture was picked up by a group of five other cadets, and the wildly grinning Nert bowed back, accepting the adulation.
"That was your idea?"
Perkins asked, with tears of laughter rolling down her cheeks.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"Because you might have said no," Dave explained. "If you did say no, you would have been wrong, ma'am."
"I can see that,"
Perkins agreed as she watched the seated Nert continue to accept back slaps and admiring gestures from the audience, including a couple very amused officers.
"You did that for Nerdy?"
Shauna whispered into Jesse's ear, now squeezing his hand with distinct affection. Jesse nodded.
It was Dave's idea. We coached him. He needed a way to show he can be cool, you know. Poor little guy was sitting all alone in the galley.
Shauna pulled away from Jesse's ear to look closely into his eyes.
That was a wonderful thing to do. Jesse Coulter, I may be falling for you.
Don't say it, don't say it, don't say it, J
Jesse warned himself. Do not blow it by saying those three words right now.
Instead of fatefully risking a premature reply of I love you, Jesse listened to his inner voice of reason and merely nodded while gently squeezing her hand. At that moment, he could not remember ever being so happy. The laughter settled down to sporadic chuckles as the next act set up their instruments on the stage. Perkins's gaze swept the room, taking in cadets still pointing to Nert and chuckling with approval, until she saw Biff and his crew. The senior cadet was glaring pure hatred at Nert, talking to his crew in a low voice, and he smacked a fist into a palm. This could be trouble, Perkins thought to herself. Since her people had just given Biff another reason to hate Nert, she felt responsible. Dave, she began to whisper, then coughed at the realization she had used the sergeant's first name because that seemed so natural. Sergeant Chaika, I need you to keep an eye on that senior cadet, she said with a meaningful glance toward Biff. He might be trouble for Nert. Perkins's instincts were right. After the talent show, Biff and his friends confronted Nert in the passageway and were not deterred by Jesse and Dave standing next to their alien friend. Biff's jaw was set, and he squeezed a fist in anger while he jabbed a finger at the two humans.
It is an insult that I am stuck aboard a vessel of war with you primitive humans and treacherous Kristang. Our leaders indulge their pets too much.
Ah, Jesse waved a hand in a dismissive gesture. Don't you worry about it, Bifty. We know you being here is an insult, but we don't let it bother us none.
What? The senior cadet sputtered. It is not an insult to you. It is an insult to my people.
Hey, man, whatever turns you on, Dave shrugged.
Turns me on?
Biff repeated slowly as he ran back the translation, confused. Then, thinking he understood, the pink skin of his face grew red under the light fuzz of fur.
I do not get sexually excited.
Not ever?
Nert spoke up before Dave or Jesse could reply.
Well, with a face like that, it's best not to get your hopes up.
Dave did not know which reaction was more extreme, the uproar of laughter at Biff's expense or the murderous look of hatred that the embarrassed senior cadet shot toward Nert. Even the three cadets in Biff's crew could not help laughing at their leader's plight, and Biff ground his incisors before spinning and attempting to stomp dramatically away, squeezing through the laughing crowd in the passageway. Except the toe of one boot tripped on something, sending Biff crashing into the doorframe. His dignity completely gone, Biff ran around a corner. His three companions recovered as best they could, their shoulders still shaking with laughter, and hurried out the door.
Nerdy. Man. Damn! Dave held out a hand.
That was classic!
Nert slapped Dave's hand and offered a high five to Jesse.
Thank you,
Nert said simply, having been coached not to ruin the moment by grandstanding.
What is this?
Another cadet asked, holding up a hand hesitantly.
This?
Nert slapped the cadet's outstretched hand, more gently than he had done with the two humans.
This is a human gesture of joy and approval. They call it a high five, he explained and counted off his five fingers.
With a grin, he added,
if Kristang did this, they would call it a high four.
Ha! Jesse grinned back. You are on fire today, Nerdy.
For a second, Nert froze, not understanding them. Then he smiled as his translator earpiece explained it to him. Dave noticed the Ruhar cadets were tentatively giving high fives to each other, hesitantly tapping palms.
Jesse, let's show them how it's done, huh? Hey, cadets, let's say your friend, he pointed to Jesse, just scored a point to win a game. You give him this. Up high.
The men slapped over their heads.
Down low. A slap at waist level. Behind the back.
They spun to complete the gesture.
And finish with this.
They jumped high and slapped hard enough that Dave's hands stung from the impact.
Oh!
Nert's eyes were wide with admiration.
Could you show us that again?
Jesse and Dave obliged the cadets, then watched as the eager Ruhar tried to follow, including Nert. When several Ruhar crashed into chairs while attempting a too enthusiastic jump, Dave called a halt.
Whoa, okay, that's good. Save it for when you have something real to celebrate, huh?
Yes, Sergeant Chaika,
Nert said slowly, beaming at Dave in hero worship.
Could you explain this, please?
He held a fist up close to his chest and slowly pushed it toward the human.
Aw, man, you got it right.
Dave bumped the fist.
Gently, huh? Don't want to go so hard you hurt yourself, right? We call that a fist bump. It's like a quick high five, I guess.
Half an hour later, the two men walked into the common area of the living quarters to find Perkins studying something on her laptop.
You two look happy about something, she observed.
Yes, we are, Dave replied and bumped fists with Jesse. Man, the only thing on this ship cooler than Nert right now are humans. Us.
He shook his head in wonderment. Chapter 10 Dave was startled awake from an all-too-brief nap by Jesse shaking his shoulder excitedly.
Part of the battle group is back. A destroyer just jumped in to recon the assembly zone. It'll jump back out soon to give the all-clear. Then the task force will be here, he announced with a gleeful shout. Come on, man. You don't want to miss this. I was watching it on the display in the briefing room, and one of the hamster kids there said he noticed battle damage to that destroyer. I'm on it.
Dave rubbed sleep from his eyes, now fully awake, swinging his feet down onto the deck. He knew there wasn't anything he could see on the display in the briefing room that he couldn't view on his Z-phone or the display built into the bulkhead of their tiny bunk room, but being with people made everything seem so much more real. When he got to the briefing room, Jesse was disappointed to see the big display on the opposite bulkhead was showing only their ship and a blinking ring off to the side. He couldn't tell how far they were from whatever the blinking ring was, because the display didn't include any sort of distance scale. Captain Strebitch was seated in front, and Captain Bonsu was strapping in beside her.
What happened, ma'am? Dave asked, also disappointed. Where'd that destroyer go?
Where are the hamsters? Jesse asked, with a glance back over his shoulder through the open door.
The destroyer jumped away. You just missed it, Irene answered.
That ring, she pointed to the display, represents the spatial distortion effect of their outbound jump.
You can't see it. That's a projection by the display.
She also checked the doorway.
Hamster kids bugged out of here when too many humans came in here.
She emphasized her words with a single-finger gesture that was not befitting an officer.
Damn, she winked. I hate it when it does that, she remarked while shaking her hand.
That was quick. Dave shrugged towards Jesse. The destroyer just got here.
The destroyer was just performing a recon jump to assure the task force that the AZ is clear. They had to wait for their sensors to reset after coming through the jump, and they had to wait for distortion of the inbound jump to stop vibrating spacetime so they could form an outbound jump wormhole, she explained. They were able to jump back early because the toaster, she gestured to the deck to indicate she was referring to the ship, gave them the all clear. Usual procedure would require the destroyer to sweep a bubble 5 light minutes in every direction before they okayed the task force to jump into the AZ.
When will the task force be jumping here? Perkins asked as she strode into the briefing room, coming forward to take one of the seats in the front row and slipping a safety strap loosely around her waist.
ASAP, if they follow standard procedure, ma'am, Derek responded. Every second they wait, the gamma rays of that destroyer's inbound and outbound jumps are expanding outward and illuminating the AZ to enemy ships like shining a strobe light. The task force needs to get here, reset their sensors and shields, and maneuver into a defensive formation before an enemy can pinpoint the AZ and react. The hardest thing to remember about the rules of space combat is that ships can travel much faster than sensor data. If a ship sends out detectable energy, like an active sensor pulse or gamma rays, the enemy can pick up that energy and jump right on top of you before your sensor pulse returns to you.
Perkins nodded silently, because she had been learning space combat tactics in her own training.
I told the Ruhar that I would be slow to learn about space combat because I'm not a pilot, and my instructor told me that is not a problem. Their opinion is the humans best able to transition to space combat would be our submarine commanders.
Subs,
Jesse asked. Like, underwater, man?
I can see that, Dave mused, with a hand rubbing his chin in deep thought.
Huh? Jesse looked at his friend in puzzlement.
Think about it, Pone. Subdrivers have to rely on stealth. They can't go pinging the ocean with sonar or they give away their position.
Correct, Perkins nodded happily. A submarine crew is also used to relying on passive sensor data of an enemy they won't ever see, and they spend months at sea in a metal tube without ever seeing the sun.
I've seen plenty of suns on this cruise, Jesse shook his head. But it's different looking at a star through a helmet visor when your feet aren't on solid ground, or any ground at all.
He was interrupted by Irene's excited shout. Two ships just jumped in. Correction, one ship just jumped in. The other jumped in almost a minute ago, but it's 57 light seconds away, so we're just seeing it now.
Irene fiddled with the controls built into the arm of her chair, zooming in the image to show the closest warship, a destroyer.
That doesn't look good.
The ship had a long gouge out of its belly, with the scar wrapping around to the starboard side. Sparks flared from the damage area, and the destroyer's nose was flattened and smashed in. It was more difficult to detect if the second ship was damaged because it was farther away and the bulkhead display only had access to low-level sensors.
Ma'am, Irene turned to Perkins. You have access to command systems?
Limited access, Perkins grimaced. The access that had been granted to her was only for training purposes. She didn't know if it would provide any real-time tactical data. To her surprise, she was able to pull up a status summary on her tablet, though the system wouldn't let her feed the info to the bulkhead display so her team could view it.
You're right, Strebitz, this is not good. The Ruhar got into a battle against the Wargalin. Our friends thought they had the upper hand. Then the Bosphorak stepped in, and the Ruhar had to bug out.
Bosphorak? Derek expressed alarm.
I thought there was an unwritten rule that species only fight an equivalent level of technology.
It's more of a custom, Perkins replied with an angry look on her face. Usually the Bosphorak send the Wargalin to fight the Ruhar or Torgala, while the Bosphorak reserve their own forces to tangle with the Giraptha. Beating up on lower-tech species risks intervention by the higher-ups. Apparently this time the Bosphorak decided that stepping into this battle was worth the risk of the Rindaloo slapping them down.
The Ruhar lost a cruiser, she reported with shock, having just seen that tactical update.
A cruiser? Dave asked, dismayed.
The task force only had two cruisers, other than the old training ship.
Does it say what happened to the other task force?
Perkins shook her head, causing a lock of hair to swing down in front of her eyes. Dave's gaze followed the hair, mesmerized.
The Star Carrier was supposed to pick them up first. We won't know their status until they jump in here.
People, the toaster could be maneuvering soon. I expect us to be put on Grade 2 alert soon. Let's get our gear and come back here and...
She was interrupted by a blaring alarm, announcing the ship was at alert condition 2.
Like I said.
They returned in less than 4 minutes, with everyone dressed in pressure suits and carrying a bag containing gloves, helmets, and extra life support packs. In battle, the humans did not have assigned action stations because the Ruhar did not want lowly aliens getting in the way. Perkins checked with the duty officer to see if she could report to the bridge and was told, politely but firmly, that she could best help the ship's operations by keeping away of Ruhar engaged in their jobs. Emily Perkins found that mildly insulting, as on the way back to the briefing room she saw young Ruhar cadets racing toward their duty stations. Even Nert was assigned to a damage control party amidships. She pinged him to ask if he was okay, and he replied only with a terse yes before cutting the connection. When Perkins got back to the briefing room, her entire team was there. Shauna was wearing a full spacesuit, having been in training when the alert sounded.
Ma'am, Shauna looked up from helping Jesse attach his helmet.
Any news?
Not much.
The Ruhar were hit by a group of Wargalin ships, and the battle was going well enough. Then a Bosphorak cruiser jumped into the action. Our allies think the Bosphorak stepped in to help the Octopussies.
Excuse me, ma'am.
Octopussies? Jesse looked to his companions, who were equally confused.
I've never met one, of course, Perkins explained. Like the Theranon,
Our info about other species comes mostly from the Ruhar. We know the Theranon look like little green men, right? Her team nodded, so she continued. Apparently the Wargalin are a sort of land octopus, so at HQ we call them octopussies. The Bosphorok are worried about the weakness of the Wargalin, so they're assisting them directly. The Bosphorok think the Theranon did too little too late to help the Kristang, and now the Theranon themselves got beat badly, and the Kristang are useless to assist. The Bosphorok are determined not to let Wargalin weakness harm their ability to control territory. Perkins lowered her voice and glanced toward the door to assure no Ruhar were listening. From the report, she tapped her tablet. I get the feeling the Ruhar are very concerned about this development. If the patron species are going to step in directly against the hamsters, then our allies need to reconsider their ability to hold territory they recently took from the lizards. Hell, ma'am. Jesse looked stricken. Does that include paradise? I don't. Perkins hesitated because that thought had not crossed her mind. I don't think so. At least not now. The concern is about territory the lizards held until the Theranon got their asses whipped by the Giratha in the past couple years. The Ruhar thought they could just kick the tires and decide which planets they want to keep. Now it looks like the Giratha may hold them back until the Beatles understand just how serious the Bosphorok are about defending their coalition's territory. Colonel, Dave asked hopefully, does this apply only to territory near space controlled by the Bosphorok? No, Perkins shook her head. The task force was far from Bosphorok space when they got jumped. This is something new. The Giratha may now be fighting the Bosphorok about who controls territory the Theranon lost. Because the Bosphorok will give it back to the Theranon once they rebuild their strength? Shauna asked, though she thought she already knew the answer to that question. No, Perkins snorted. The Bosphorok and Theranon hate each other more than they hate the Giratha. This development is likely the result of the Bosphorok taking advantage of Theranon weakness to cherry-pick star systems they want for themselves. My guess is the Giratha will need to test the Bosphorok to see where they will push back. This has gotta be. She let out a long breath and swept her hair back before pulling her helmet over her head. Frustrating to the Giratha. Frustrating. They probably love this, Dave interjected. Not knowing what territory the Bosphorok might fight to hold is going to provide super juicy wagering action for the Giratha. The Ruhar say those beetles will bet on anything. This has got to have them excited out of their minds. You may be right about that, Dave. Perkins almost used his first name. Blushing inside her helmet, she corrected herself. Chaika, we may find out when that star carrier returns. Inwardly, she groaned when another thought struck her. While it was good to observe their allies in real action, the losses suffered by the task force very likely meant the training crews would be cut short before humans could fully qualify for space duty and demonstrate their ability to operate effectively alongside the hamsters. If the war in the sector was now entering a dangerous and unpredictable phase, opportunity for further training may be delayed significantly. Hopefully it gets back here soon. Irene zoomed the display image outward, expanding to show another ship that had jumped in 68 light seconds away and was now accelerating hard to form up with the others. What are they like? Dave asked. The Giratha? Irene held up her hands. We've never met them. But you and Captain Bonsu have flown to their ship? That was only to practice manual docking procedures, Irene explained. We flew into one of their docking bays, waited for the clamps to engage and release. Then we flew out, kind of like doing touch-and-goes with aircraft. There was a Giratha who talked to us, but we never even saw one of the beetles. The gallery above the docking bay was empty. We were told the Giratha are not unfriendly to lower species. The crew of the Star Carrier was just very busy with all the training going on. Is their ship really called the Deal Me In? Jesse asked. A cadet told me that, and I didn't know if he was playing a joke on me. No joke, Irene assured the soldier. The name does translate as Deal Me In, or close enough. You think the Beatles will really bet on what places the Bosphorok will defend? Jesse continued. Derek answered the question. From what I've heard, the Giratha will bet on pretty much anything. What I wonder is whether their intel people base their assessments on wagering. They would do that? Shauna was shocked by such an idea. Not based on their own bets, Derek explained.
I meant based on what the overall Jarraptha public is wagering on.
Yes, Perkins agreed with a nod toward Derek. That type of crowdsourced prediction model can often be more accurate than the assessments of so-called experts. When I was at the Pentagon, we were looking at using a prediction market system to forecast future threats.
Ma'am? Jesse blinked.
What kind of market?
Market-based. Think of it like drafting a fantasy football team where you're using real money to buy players you think will perform well the next season. At the Pentagon, we experimented with a team of threat assessment people to project the next hotspot. We created a sort of market where people could buy binary options and various potential threat scenarios, with the value of a particular threat rising as the threat became more likely. And before you say it sounds like a crapshoot, Perkins gave a disarming smile at Jesse. That system predicted we would be in Nigeria 14 months before the president pulled the trigger to put boots on the ground there.
Holy crap, Jesse gasped. Come on, Cornpone, we were talking about us going into Nigeria way back when we were in boot camp, Dave reminded his friend.
Well, yeah, but I didn't think people were betting on it.
I know it sounds sketchy, Perkins said with sympathy. But the Jarraptha might just be crowdsourcing their strategic intel using real money through a wagering system, she added with a faraway look on her face, the wheels turning in her head. As a former intelligence officer, she would love to know how accurate the Jarraptha system was in real life.
It sounds crazy, Derek agreed, but it may work as well as any system we have.
I'll stick to fantasy sports, Jesse replied, chagrined.
Nobody gets killed.
If the Jarraptha intel scopes out right, less people will get killed, Dave argued.
Prediction markets aren't perfect, Perkins admitted.
To be useful, you need to filter out what people think will happen from what they think the popular opinion is. Too many times, people in the market try to guess what the herd is thinking rather than using their own gut.
The glazing eyes of her audience told Perkins she was getting way too nerdy on that subject.
Health agencies on Earth have been using predictive markets to project flu outbreaks for years, and they work pretty well. If we ever get an opportunity to talk with the Jarraptha, I'll ask them about it.
Ha! Jesse laughed. They'll want to bet with you about what you think the answer is. Those beetles...
Irene interrupted him.
Star Carrier jumped in.
Damn, they really nailed that jump. Exactly in the center of their target emergence point.
Her voice reflected the admiration she felt.
2.4 light seconds away. We should start moving.
An alarm blared and Irene smiled.
Like I said, we will start moving soon.
Within seconds, they felt a gentle tug to the right as the ship turned, then fired its engines. Irene watched the thrust indicator on the bottom of the display and was pleased that her guess based on feel matched what the display showed. The Rue to Stella was not moving quickly. As a non-combatant and not having suffered any battle damage, the training cruiser would be last in line to latch onto the Star Carrier. It hung back away from the cluster of warships approaching their assigned docking platforms, with the toaster providing an overall sensor view of the area and acting as a backup traffic controller to assist the Jarraptha crew of the Star Carrier. Irene noticed something odd right away, and when she looked up to catch Perkins's eye, the colonel nodded with concern. She had seen it too.
"Those ships are in a hurry," Irene said quietly.
"A big, goddamned hurry."
"Looks like it," Perkins agreed.
Normal procedure for docking with the Jarraptha Star Carrier was for ships to approach one at a time, remaining outside the imaginary bubble of space within which the Jarraptha ship's AI took control from the docking ship's navigation system until the Star Carrier authorized them to proceed inward. Only when one ship was securely attached to a docking platform and powered down was a subsequent ship given clearance to approach. Due to the poor maneuverability of Star Carriers, the Jarraptha were understandably worried about bulky armored warships clumsily crashing into each other, or into the vulnerable long spine of their space truck. What Perkins and Strebitch noticed was the Ruhar warships were approaching in groups of three, with the remaining two ships close behind. Though battle damage to the Ruhar ships rendered some of them awkward to handle, the Jarraptha appeared to be more concerned about completing the docking operation as quickly as possible than about navigation safety. The two human women shared a look, and they both pulled their seat straps tighter.
"People," Perkins ordered, Let's get buttoned up. She reached under the seat for her helmet. I think once this ship gets moving for real, it could be a rough ride. At the moment, their cruiser was proceeding toward the star carrier at a leisurely rate of acceleration, hanging back to give the battle-damaged warships clearance to maneuver onto the docking platforms.
"What's up, Colonel?" Jesse asked.
Irene answered for Perkins.
"The Jarapta are breaking safe docking protocol. They're going for combat latching. That means incoming ships fly a partly independent approach, get onto whatever docking platform they can reach ASAP, and hold on with their own magnetic grapples as best they can. The Beatles are worried about something. They want to jump out of here pronto."
"They won't jump without us, will they?" Dave asked, hoping he knew the answer.
"No," Derek assured the soldier. Irene acted as the killjoy.
"They won't if they can help it, but the Beatles aren't going to risk their star carrier and a dozen warships for a training cruiser. If they think they're in jeopardy, they'll jump away, and we'll be on our own. We'll be on our own for a short time."
Derek shot the other pilot a look. "Chaika, all it means is if the star carrier jumps away, we jump away also and meet up at a pre-programmed AZ.
"What if that AZ is hot also?" Shauna asked.
"Then we go to the alternate AZ, and then another.
Look, Jared, Chaika, the Ruhar and Jarapta have been doing this for a very long time."
Derek said it in a calm, steady voice.
"Probably before humans had any form of writing. They know what they're doing. And," he added for emphasis, "they've been kicking the lizards and Theranans' asses all over this sector."
"Besides," Irene chimed in unhelpfully, "we're just a training ship. In a battle, we would be the last ship targeted."
"Yeah, because we're the most vulnerable," Shauna rolled her eyes at Irene.
"Sorry," Irene muttered. Just then, another alarm blared, and the ship's acceleration increased noticeably.
"The Jarapta want us docked as soon as possible, too," she said as she watched the display project the ship's course, straight into a docking platform in the middle of the star carrier between two other ships. "The Jarapta must be confident their undamaged ship could tuck into that tight space," Irene thought to herself, while they are directing the incoming battle-damaged warships onto platforms that had plenty of empty space around them.
"Captain Strebich," Dave asked, pointing at the display.
"What's that destroyer doing?"
"A go-around," Irene guessed. She had watched the stricken destroyer approach its assigned platform clumsily. Clearly, that ship's damaged propulsion system was making it difficult to control its flight. The destroyer had fired its thrusters on full to avoid a collision with another incoming ship, overcorrected, and been forced to back away using its main engines.
"The Jarapta waved it off. It will have to try again."
"What if they can't do it?" Shauna asked, fearing for the crew of the destroyer.
"They'll have three options," Derek explained. "They can get tugboats to tow them in."
"They won't have time for that," Irene said quietly. "Those tugs are designed to move dropships, not starships."
"Or they can remain stationary, and the star carrier can maneuver to latch them on.
I sure wouldn't want to do that, even if we weren't in a hurry."
Derek shook his head at the thought of the massive star carrier, burdened with warships, trying to perform the delicate operation of moving precisely enough to position a docking platform under the belly of the destroyer. Shauna unconsciously pulled her arms tightly around herself from anxiety.
"What's the third option?"
"Abandon ship," Irene replied. "Get the crew off in dropships, send the ship away on autopilot. They can recover the ship later, or set it to self-destruct."
"That's not optimal," Perkins noted. "They probably have wounded aboard. Moving them to dropships will take time and risk interrupting their medical treatment."
"Yes, ma'am," Irene agreed in a soothing tone. "The Ruhar have a procedure for that. I'm sure that ship's command crew began prepping their medical teams to transport the wounded as soon as they realized the ship wasn't responding properly to her helm."
"I hope they did."
Shauna clenched her fists as she spoke.
"Look," Derek pointed. "That destroyer is opening docking bay doors. They're preparing to abandon ship."
It was Emily Perkins's turn to clench her fists. If the Jarapta were junking a destroyer after one failed docking attempt, the Beatles must be very concerned about getting away from the assembly zone as quickly as possible. That meant the Beatles expected trouble.
and that was not good. Before she could halt her tongue, she muttered aloud,
I hope this doesn't turn into a fight. If we have to fight, this could get kinetic in a hurry, Irene warned.
Their cruiser was significantly behind the other ships in line for docking. Even with the toaster's command crew now twisting the cruiser's tail to get it moving faster, they would not be docking for over 20 minutes. Distances in space were vast, and the ship's approach speed was limited, because however hard they accelerated toward the star carrier, they would need to cancel their relative speed before docking.
Yeah, Derek grimaced. We throw that term around loosely, but remember out here, kinetic can be measured as a percentage of light speed. A fleck of paint could punch through the hull armor.
He rapped knuckles on a bulkhead. If it's going fast enough.
Captain?
Jesse did not like the mental image of being killed by a tiny fleck of paint.
You are a genuine confidence booster.
Despite the anxiety of the team's pilots, who could only watch the combat latching operation, all the warships attached themselves, even the destroyer that had been waved off its first attempt to connect with a docking platform. The Rue Torstella was the last ship to contact a platform, and the clamps had barely engaged when the star carrier jumped. Chapter 11
No, the Ruhar flight instructor said with a plastered-on smile and a forcibly pleasant and patient tone that came across as irritated, impatient, and patronizing, as if she were speaking to a young child who could not understand how to perform a simple task.
You first have to
switch to the independent mode, yes, I know that, and that is why I have the mode selected.
Irene replied through gritted teeth, using her right pinky finger to indicate the independent operation symbol in bold letters at the top of the touchscreen display. With two human pilots learning to fly the starship from the auxiliary control center, the displays were converted to English words and symbols familiar to humans, like having positive indicators in green and negatives in red.
You don't have to be nasty about it,
the flight instructor huffed. Her translated words coming across as distinctly frosty.
I wasn't being nasty.
Irene tensed in her pilot's couch, but kept her eyes focused on the displays instead of turning to confront their alien instructor. It slightly irritated Irene that they were being instructed by a young Ruhar whose rank of Clasta was roughly equivalent to a second lieutenant, while Irene and Derek were captains with many thousands of hours of real flight experience. Clasta Splun was freshly graduated from the academy, having taken the low-status assignment aboard the toaster, only to build up flight hours in her logbook. The alien had little real-world flight experience. She was clearly bored and angry about being assigned to teach humans, and Irene wasn't taking any crap from her.
"I do not like your tone, human,"
Splun ground her incisors as she spoke.
I do not like being spoken to like a child by an instructor who can't read her own display,
Irene shot back, knowing that although the Ruhar probably could not or would not read the English symbols on the two pilot displays, the Clasta had standard Ruhar common language symbols on the displays at the instructor station. The Clasta tensed, lifting a finger to halt the simulation.
Perhaps it would be best if...
Derek turned in his couch to face their instructor, jabbing an accusing finger at her in a gesture he knew she understood.
Perhaps it would be best if you do the job you have been assigned. If you are not capable of that, we can request a more qualified instructor right now.
He held up a Z-phone.
Good idea,
Irene began to agree.
And you, he turned to his fellow pilot, do your job and leave out the comments. We've both had asshole instructors before, and you aren't making things any better.
He leaned toward Irene and pressed a button to transfer control to his station.
My spacecraft, he declared as he assumed the role of pilot in command.
Initiating approach, he stated as he authorized thrusters for manual operation.
Are you good, Clasta Splun? Yes, came the curt reply.
Sorry.
Irene's voice was soft. Then louder.
Monitoring remote guidance. Guide beam acquired and active.
Acquisition confirmed.
The Ruhar behind them confirmed in a voice that held only a hint of anger.
Proceed at 1/4 power. Watch your heading, she added in a reproachful tone.
Heading dialed in, Derek reported with a smile and a wink toward Irene.
He had the ship exactly on the designated heading, not only within the green band of acceptable error, but near the blue centerline of optimal course. Derek Bonsu had learned the best way to respond to someone trying to bait you was to never take the bait. Ignore the insults, plaster a fake smile on your face, and pretend you did not understand an insult was intended. That often turned the tables and made his opponents lose their temper, while he just had a good laugh.